Welcome to the Digital Forester Podcast, where we speak to forestry leaders and innovators who are shaping the future of forestry. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Digital Forester Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Nicholas Koops. He's a Canada Research Chair in Remote Sensing in the Department of Forest Resources Management at University of British Columbia, in addition to leading the Integrated Remote Sensing Studio. I feel that was very long set of titles. But of course, I also know most listeners of this podcast will recognize Dr. Koops' name, illustrious career, lots of great things happening. But Nicholas, how are you doing today?
Very well, thanks. Great to be here, Kevin. Thanks for doing this.
Awesome. And where am I reaching you at today? I know you travel a lot. We were just talking about traveling around the world before starting the podcast there. But where am I reaching you today?
I'm in Vancouver, Canada. So that's where the University of British Columbia is based. So my home, I live in Vancouver and the university is here. My office is here. I'm a big Lego guy. And as a research, a way of de-stressing in the research lab, we build Lego sets together. So they all get then mounted in my office. So you're seeing about a quarter of them, but there's it's a whole Lego office. If anyone wants to come by and look at it, you're welcome to pop in.
So is this part of the screening criteria, Nicholas? If you want to work on Dr. Koops's lab, you got to build the Millennium Falcon. And for our listeners, not viewers, there's like some really big Lego pieces mounted on the wall.
There are some.
Yeah. So these are not like one-hour things.
It'd be a good start. A good thing to add to the CV.
Okay, perfect. So bribe Dr. Koops with lots of new Lego things. I'll bring my kids Lego Ninjago to the table there and while you're with there. So very cool. So thanks for joining and definitely lots to talk about. But with the podcast, I always like to ask folks about their journey. And that's one of the number one feedback from people. They're like, I didn't know this about this person. I've met them. I've known them for years. I didn't even know their origin story. So obviously for our listeners, viewers, and listening to the audio, it's like, Nicholas doesn't sound like me, although I'm sure now you'll add the A in there all the odd time there. But maybe tell us where you started with your studies and your journey up to maybe your PhD to start.
Sounds good. Clearly, I'm not Canadian. So I'm Australian. I was born in Melbourne, Australia, born and raised, and pretty unsure during my high school years about what I actually wanted to go away and do. I very much like mapping. I very much liked looking at the world from above. And I actually did my undergraduate degree in cartography, which is the making of maps. And I learned that traditional way where you used to make maps with pen and paper. And I did my undergraduate degree in that. But at the time, GIS was just starting. So this idea of digital mapping was really starting at the mid-80s. Esri had just come onto the scene. It was like ARC version 1. Remote sensing was sort of starting as well in terms of personal computers. ERDAS was perhaps the biggest player at the time. And so it was sort of in the last year of my undergrad that we started getting introduced to digital methods. And I was immediately wowed by remote sensing. It was a course that I immediately loved. And I knew that I didn't want to keep making maps. And I decided to do remote sensing for my master's. So I stayed at the university. I was at Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, which is in Melbourne, and I stayed there for my master's. And then it was picking up, and I actually stayed there for my PhD. I wanted to stay in remote sensing, but RMIT was a relatively small, unknown university in Melbourne, and so I didn't have too many choices around what I'd do my PhD on, but I knew I wanted to do it in remote sensing. So I ended up doing my PhD in remote sensing of clouds. So I worked with the Bureau of Meteorology, and I mapped and made a cloud atlas from satellite imagery, not the imagery we'd use today, more from meteorological satellites. But that was really it just built my interest. And I did sort of play with different types of remote sensing data, and the university was growing in that area. There was TA opportunities. I really started to play with different types of remote sensing imagery. And at the end of the PhD, I was done. I was actually not particularly interested in clouds anymore, certainly not interested in meteorology, but very still interested in remote sensing. And I was very, very lucky to jump straight into a research position with CSIRO, which is the Australian Research Government Organization, and it happened to be in forestry. So remote sensing of forests. So people sort of look at my career and say, how long have you been a forester for? I'm not a forester, really. I've never trained in forestry. And forestry remote sensing, I've learnt that as I went. It was really the spark of interest in remote sensing that got me into it in the first place, and then forestry since then. To finish the story, I was at CSIRO for 10 years, and then moved to Vancouver to pick up the job here as a professor, really to continue the same sort of research. Canada and Australia, very similar in our culture, but also quite similar in the way we use remote sensing. Big countries, not many people. Very similar approaches, but it also has the educational component that I wanted to get into in my career as well, which is why I then flipped from Australia and moved to Canada.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. And out of curiosity, coming from Australia to Canada, was that a hard move? As adults, you go through graduate school, you earn your degrees and stuff, but moving like across the globe, right? Like how did that go? Was that like scary, or is that like, we're so similar in culture that, in a month I already felt at home in Vancouver. And of course, Vancouver is different than other parts of Canada, but what can you share on that for some of our folks that, in today's climate, probably needs to move around, from an employment point of view, let alone on the academic side versus private sector. Was that an easy move for you?
Yes, I think it was. Those of you have people have heard me talk about my feeling that an academic's life or even a researcher's life is sort of 10 to 15 year blocks. As academics and researchers, we can't move very quickly because if we have a research project, these research projects take years. We do research projects for 4 years, 6 years, 8 years, 10 years. We have students that take 4 years, 5 years to finish. So an academic doesn't move around a lot very quickly because there's sort of this institutional inertia, because we have students and grants that take long periods of time. So that was true even in research organizations as well. You maybe don't have the students, but you sort of have, there's a longer sense there. So my view is, we as academics, we probably have 10 or 15 year chunks of our life, and we move between those different chunks. And so I was always keen to move. I was always open to the idea. I always thought I would. And so I did my time at CSIRO and then I moved here. And actually, people, a funny thing is that when I arrived in Vancouver, I was telling everyone, oh, I'm going to be gone in a decade. I'm going to be gone. This is my second time. I'm going to do a third role somewhere else. I've been here 20 years, so my plan has fallen apart. I don't think I will move again into another academic position. I'd like to return to Australia ultimately, and I would like to work in Australia, but I'm not leaving Vancouver anytime soon. But I do think as academics and as researchers, moving is good. I think it's really good. That's why we have sabbaticals as well, to some extent. Just being exposed to other people, other ideas, other way of doing things, I think is really, really important. And academics do get stale. We do get locked in our own worlds. And so I think travel and speaking to people and taking these opportunities and moving is really important in academia to keep yourself fresh.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know for our audience, typically there's a stereotype of like, oh, the academics, they go on vacation for a year when they hear that word sabbatical. And that's really not the case. To your point, it's to broaden your horizons, meet new people, get exposed to new ideas. Now, one of the things I love talking with people on this podcast, and I don't know if it's a function of us working in this space, but everybody's super humble. So the one thing for folks, our audience, to know is when you came to Canada, you came as a Canada research chair. And I'm just wondering if you can explain to our audience like what that means, because this is not just a, oh, anybody gets it, right? Like this is a very like handpicked best of the best in the field that are awarded Canada research chairs. So maybe can you introduce the CRC program to our listeners and how that fits into what you do?
Sure. So the Canada Research Chair is a federal government initiative from Canada. So it gives the universities extra funds to attract or keep these scholars that they, successful scholars that can sort of propel the research in those particular areas. So a lot of universities in all universities in Canada would have access to these chair programs. And then these chairs are sort of established, where they bring in the researcher. I get operating money to help support my students. Not a lot, but some. But critically, the university gets my salary paid through this program. And it's and I get a teaching release. So it reduces my teaching a little bit. It gives me some operating, but it just gives me that ability to focus on my research. And it's these key themed areas within the CRC program that are in universities and then across Canada. So I'm sure many listeners may have come across a few different CRCs across Canada working in all different areas, and there's quite a few working in the area of remote sensing as well. I'm not the only one, but I certainly focus myself on remote sensing in forestry applications, and based in Vancouver. It's been great. I mean, I take the responsibility with it to think that I need to be responsive to the public, for example. They see Canada Research Channel Remote Sensing, so I do try to, where I can, always be responsive to anyone, private companies, NGOs, governments, about remote sensing. And I do think that's part of the gig, that if we're the Canadian public are investing in this program, then we should be as responsive as we can as CRCs back to them. But yeah, it actually ends in a couple of years. So they are finite positions. They're not lifelong positions. They're renewed, and there's processes of renewal, but I'm actually up for that in a year or so. I'll just become a regular standard professor. But yeah, it's been a great ride, and very much appreciate it.
Yeah, no, very cool. And of course, being responsive to podcast hosts when they reach out,
Indeed.
hey, you need to
Social
come up,
media,
right?
very important.
Absolutely. It's the most important thing in the world. And yeah, so at
Indeed.
the end of the day, very, very prestigious. The Canada Research Chair programs are very prestigious positions there. So very cool on that front. So maybe on the in the podcast, typically we've talked a lot about GIS, geospatial thingies, and on this one, just given your background, like you're an expert in the field of remote sensing and forestry applications and forest science. And so I might kind of focus our discussion more on the earth observation side because you've kind of seen it all. You talked about GIS in the early days at MRIT, our Royal,
RMIT. Yep.
our MIT, tongue twister here, Mark. I need more coffee here. But maybe to start things off, from when you started today, is there a monumental, like a pivotal moment in time that created this monumental change in Earth observation for you? Because when I think back to my schooling, there was always the, multispectral, hyperspectral, resolution, like high spatial resolution. And then at some point, I think I saw a LinkedIn post where somebody was saying, oh, it's like, 10 centimeter imagery. Is this, what resolution are we at now? So just curious to think about your experiences to date and watching the landscape of Earth observation unfold. What surprised you maybe over the last few years? And then is there a monumental shift there that you're like, wow, this is a game changer?
So, in a forestry context, the biggest game change you've ever had is LIDAR. It has fundamentally revolutionized the way we do forestry around the world. It has validated the hopes and prayers of remote sensing scientists worldwide, in that we actually have a technology that we don't overpromise and actually can deliver on. So I think that was what, mid-2000s, that I think the power of LIDAR moved from, an incredibly interesting research tool to something operational. And I think now in the next decade, well, 15 years since 2005, it's been a massive success story with many people contributing to its demonstration. So revolution number one. I think 2008, when Landsat data became free and open, and this expectation then around free and open data, downloadable, calibrated surface reflectance, that was done initially by the Americans, which I think has then brought many countries online to continue to do that, is cannot be underestimated as a revolution in terms of the use of remote sensing data. The fact that remote sensing data is now as important as climate data, as we think about the future climate and how the Earth is changing. We know we need it. We know we need temperature. We know we need surface reflectance. So to me, this is revolution number two. I do think drones are revolutionizing the way we collect data, and putting the data back in the hands of ordinary citizens to collect their own data. I think that's probably been 5 years, perhaps. I don't think we can underestimate how significant that platform has become for forestry today. And then perhaps the most recent revolution, but I don't think we can underestimate, is, well, free and open, but perhaps transparent science. This idea that academics can't keep publishing papers on proprietary software in copyrighted journal articles, on boutique data sets over small areas that's not shared, I think those days are gone. I think all of the students coming through today have a much more democratic view of how science should be undertaken. And so we see that through things like code snippets, open code, free data, reproducible science, open access articles, podcasts, social media, LinkedIn, just this, plethora of ways that people can demonstrate their science and allow it to be validated to some extent. I don't think we can underestimate that revolution that's going to push us forward as well. So I think there are probably more, but I do regard the 90s and the early 2000s as relatively stale in terms of remote sensing revolution. And I think that LIDAR, time series, long-term archive data, free and open, drones, and then open science are perhaps the four revolutions that I think have completely changed how I do my job, how the students do their job over 20 years.
Wow. And of those revolutions you described, Nicholas, like which of those would be the one that surprised you, or if you were to look back and go like, I would never have thought this, knowing what I knew then, is there one that you're just like, oh, it's like totally cool, right? It's like amazing revolutions, but maybe caught you off guard?
Well, I think we all saw the promise of LIDAR. Those of us who saw LIDAR in the early 2000s probably knew it was going to change was afoot. I think all of us who've worked with Landsat data and Sentinel data over time have always appreciated the magnificence of looking at a time series. So I don't think that was a revolution. It wasn't a surprise to me. It was a delight that it became free and open, but it wasn't a surprise. You think about what it was like using software 10 years ago. I would have looked for graduate students who would point and click. I would have thought that software packages that were shrink wrapped were the future. I would have said we need to simplify software to a GUI, and that would be the way we move forward. That would have been my thought 10 or 15 years ago. And I suppose the great surprise now is that I think the days are limited for mega large pieces of software that are point and click. All due respect to your new role with Remsoft, I think this idea of getting under the hood, be it the students, I suppose, or the researchers, or even the people who sell the software, this flexibility, this ability to bring in different data, the huge data streams that we now have available to us, you need to have software or approaches that are flexible to do that. So now when a student comes to my lab, the question isn't, can you use Envy? Can you use Arc Pro? The question is, can you code? And I don't expect a student to be a huge Python programmer, but I expect them to understand what scripting is and love the idea of working with code. And that has surprised me because I didn't think I'd be asking for a student like that a decade ago. But I think I asked for a student like that now. And I
Interesting.
think it's not so much decoding expertise and it's not so much the software. It's more, do you understand data? Do you understand different types of data as it comes in different ways? And I suppose this has been the revolution, this sort of data, 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 everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. How do you train students to deal with that? How do you use that to the best appropriate way for the application that we want in a transparent, usable, validated, accurate way? And having students and people that can do that. And so perhaps that's the revolution that su surprised me the most, almost back to basics around this need to get to data. And perhaps I wasn't expecting that a decade ago.
Yeah, so it sounds like it's like table stakes now. If you want to do this work, you need to have some data science, if we want to use that term, right?
Term.
It's part of your toolkit there coming to the table. No, very, very cool. Very lots there. Later on in the pod, I'm going to dig in there for sure. But as an expert in forestry applications of remote sensing, where do you see current gaps? Because again, you actively research things that folks on the private sector probably don't think about. LiDAR's great, everyone's doing it. You still have these waves, I almost say, of radar comes around. I joke every decade, everyone gets excited, then everyone looks into the science and they're like, okay, that false promise, maybe as you described in the early 2000s. But there's some camps that say, you know what, LiDAR's expensive, it's still expensive. And again, we can debate that from the value you obtain from airborne LiDAR or even drone-based LiDAR. But then some folks revert back to maybe that spaceborne remote sensing type of work. And we have organizations that are trying to do LiDAR from space, all sorts of things. But in your seat, if for our maybe forestry people, boots on the ground that are listening to this, what's your recommendation? Is it really, you know what, don't like think about the noise or listen to the noise. If you're really looking at forest structure and doing inventory work, it's like you don't have a tool other than LiDAR. Or is there an alternate view, thinking of that digital photogrammetry work, SGM point clouds and whatnot? Is there an alternate approach if someone didn't want to go full blown into the LiDAR side of things? What would be your recommendation?
For sure. I mean, I think I appreciate all those points, and I think many of those are valid. Depends on the size of the area that you're working. Depends on the precision of the results that you need, and how you're going to use those for management. But LiDAR is the gold standard, and LiDAR is a technology that you should invest in and should be invested in, and is I see very much as a base layer upon which you might then go and lay these different types of remote sensing data on top. I don't think any of us are saying, go and fly LiDAR every single year. It's cost prohibitive. It could be cost prohibitive. It could be large and large amounts of data that would then go away and need to be processed. What you would always perhaps do is have LiDAR once. It's the gold standard. Maybe you collect that once every 5 years. Maybe you need it once every 10 years. The question then becomes, once you have that, how do you keep it fresh? The joke always is like buying a car. As soon as you drive the car off the lot, it's depreciated by $10,000. As soon as you throw in the LiDAR, it's old because the forest is changing. But I don't expect then that you're going to keep going away and flying more LiDAR. You would use other technologies to update that data layer through time. Trees don't change that quickly. So you might go away and link that LiDAR data to a growth model and then grow the forest through a growth model. You might go away and use optical data like Landsat, Sentinel, WorldView, Planet, and use that to go away and burn in the disturbances or map the disturbances as they're happening across the landscape. You've got digital photogrammetry. So maybe you fly with photographs, digital camera, a third the cost. Go away, build some point clouds, and use those point clouds to modify the LiDAR-based point cloud and move that through time. So I think there's lots of ways that you might do that. Perhaps you flow in a large area of LiDAR, but you're only operating on a small part of the land base, then drones might come in. Drones can update the small part of the land base where you're operating. The LiDAR still gives you that broader view. Or maybe if we're lucky and we have JedEye or iSAT-2, you've got wall-to-wall LiDAR from the initial airborne, but then you're updating that with the samples that you're getting from space to allow you then to move that data layer up through time. So the idea then would be, okay, well, after 5 or 10 years, there's now been so much change on the landscape that maybe you're getting a bit unsure. I've rolled this forward long enough. I really need to go away and check it. Then you would go and invest in another airborne LiDAR acquisition. So, I think to me, it's this idea of the gold standard once. It gives you the terrain model, which is extraordinarily valuable for a whole variety of management applications, not just the structure of the trees. Gives you these key attributes you want to go away and move forward, and then you update using these cheaper technologies that is cheaper, more open, perhaps accessible technologies or more focused technologies in small places. Use that to update, and ultimately you might come in at a later time step and redo the LiDAR. So I don't think we're telling companies or NGOs to invest in LIDAR every year and it's an ongoing cost of $100,000 a year and you've always got to go and get. No, we're not saying that. We're saying invest in a gold standard once, invest in this base layer, and then update it using these technologies as you other technologies as you need to.
Right. And thinking of that, maybe a couple rapid fire questions. Individual tree extraction from LiDAR, are we there yet? Species, do we care about that? Can we do it from LiDAR? Age is always so important. Can we do that from LiDAR? Maybe three rapid fire questions there to put you on the spot and say, what do you think? Where are we at today?
So individual trees, of course, in some environments, the plantations down in the south, individual tree detection is very accurate, very good, appropriate, easy to do. It is much more challenging in multi-species, multi-age forests, and it depends what you got. If you care about the big trees, maybe they're most of your volume, that's 90% of your volumes in the overstory, and you just care about the overstory, individual tree of overstory trees is completely appropriate. But if you're a biodiversity expert and you're trying to count the number of trees, or you want the understory trees, or you want the midstory trees, much, much, much more challenging. And it's going to get tough because your accuracies might be 70 or 80%. That 20% you're missing might be really, really important. So horses for courses. I never expect us to, I don't think we'll ever have only an individual tree-based approach. I still think the area-based approach of making cystical relationships between point clouds still has enormous value. We're still going to be seeing that used across large areas because it's a very easy way to go and process the data. But maybe you've got smaller areas that you're doing individual trees on. Maybe your management-focused areas become individual trees. Or maybe your individual tree estimates end up rolling up into the broader area-based approach that we do over large areas. So, we still have PhDs working on it. We never see accuracies much greater than 80%. We saw 80% 20 years ago. We're still seeing 80%. But I think it's horses for courses and appropriate in some places. We would love to get species as well, but we know LIDAR is not well suited to species, and we know that tree architecture, the thing that LIDAR can measure, doesn't change very much between a pine or a fir or a maple and an oak. We're stuck. So we can keep trying to do it. We've got many bright people going away and trying to pull that out of LIDAR, hoping that the high density is enough, hoping that intensity is giving us enough, hoping that multispectral LIDAR is giving us enough, but it's tough and it's always going to be tough. So we may have to think again of this sort of multi-scale or multi-resolution or multi-sensor approach. Maybe we're getting the imagery from a Maybe we're getting imagery to tell us the species. Maybe we're using the polygons that we had from the previous inventory. Trees don't change their species, so that's relatively constant, the species mix that we might expect. So maybe the forest inventory maps from a couple of decades ago, they're not perfect, but they're an interpreter telling us what the species mix is likely to be. Maybe we carry that forward and impose it into the LIDAR. Maybe hyperspectral, maybe planet. But it's tough. We're not going to be. It's certainly tough in the tropics. We know how tough it is. Even in Canada, where we don't have that many species, it's still difficult to think we're going to get species from LIDAR, and there's still a lot of, I think, a lot of work to be done there.
Yeah, absolutely. I chuckle because, we talked early on about, the early 2000s there being 90s stale, and are we coming full circle to this data fusion concept that was alive and well there, that it's not just one stop shop, it's more about taking what's available and then doing the science there to figure out how you actually solve that problem. I don't know.
Exactly.
And so along those lines, thinking of your lab and what are the problems you're working on, because I think sharing that with the audience, they'll get a sense when you say that and say, yeah, 80%. It's I always joke, it's like if you got nothing, I'll take anything more than nothing. It's progress, right? But thinking of what are the things you're working on now actively, and then if you can maybe rank them in the sense of this research, like I really don't know, and it's very innovative by default, but a lot of risk versus this is maybe more filling some more maybe applied science questions. What's the integrated lab, remote sensing lab, sort of studio, I should say, working on today?
Sure. So bread and butter would be a few things. Landsat time series. Many of I collaborate very strongly with Canadian Forest Service. We're still collectively working on Landsat Time Series Historical Archive of Landsat Large Area Assessment. Canada is huge. We need these data products. We need to understand how our forests are changing. You know, I think we've gone through a revolution. We had free and open data in 2008. We started to use that annually. Annual composites look at change. So a lot of the early work was, can we map fire? Can we map harvest? Yep, tick, done. I think we've got a lot of people going away and do that. A lot of free algorithms now, Google Earth Engine algorithms to go away and do that. I think we're done. I think we then move to recovery. A lot of the questions in the last 5 years have been, okay, well, now you see the disturbance, how is it recovering? And that's been driving a lot of the research in the last 5 years with Landsat Time Series, long archive data. What about vegetation recovery? And I think we've had a lot of people working on that in the last 5 years, getting there, almost a tick. I think the interesting question with Landsat Time Series now is non-stand replacing disturbance. So, you know, fire and harvest are easy to see from Landsat. You know, clearing the land, clearing the forest and seeing the land is something we can easily see. So of course our accuracies were going to be quite good. And of course our products are accurate. They look magnificent. And they really describe these stand replacing disturbances. But as people wrestle with climate change, how our forests changing, you know, we're not seeing massive death. We're seeing stress. We're seeing drought. We're seeing temperature stress. We're seeing frost stress. We're seeing species perhaps fall out, new species coming in. This is much more subtle in a Landsat signal over time. And this is something we haven't spent a lot of time doing because we've sort of been chomping our teeth and developing our algorithms on the stand replacing. That's where the research is going, trying to map non-stand replacing disturbances consistently and accurately and ideally attributing it. What do we think it is? Do we think it's a drought response? So to me, this, and over large areas, to me, this is the new area that we're moving now in with Landsat Time Series and Sentinel Time Series. And trying to really crack that nut. One of the issues there is phenology. So we were easy in 2008 because it was annual. We just checked every summer. So you don't have to worry about phenology if you're always checking for August 1. But if you're trying to go away and track how is our forest changing much more subtly, you probably want to do that through the year because your response might be spring or your response might be in fall. You can't just keep using August. That becomes tricky because plants are naturally having a phenological cycle. So bringing in Sentinel, bringing in Landsat together, giving us a much denser time series through the year. Sentinel's giving us increased spatial resolution that might allow us to get to some of those details as well. But you know, trying to train algorithms to go away and find this deviation from this cycle is you know where the research is going, I think, and then operationalizing that to avoid millions of pixels of noise, but going away and trying to find a signal in there around non-stand replacement disturbance, I think is really interesting and something that I would probably have four or five people in my lab looking at trying to go away and do. That's for Landsat. LiDAR, we've agreed that we've agreed airborne is operational. I do think the question now is next generation products from airborne. We know we can get volume, we know we can get basal area, we know we can get density, but what are these additional products that LiDAR, airborne LiDAR can provide that currently wouldn't be an operational product? And really in North America, a lot of that's around fire. What are the attributes of fuel that LiDAR can give us to feed into our understanding of disturbance and in particular fire? So jumping from variables like volume and basal area and height and moving to variables like canopy base height, canopy density, perhaps some understory information, midstory information. You know, these are the attributes I think that people are looking to see out of LiDAR, know we can probably get, but have always been a bit piecemeal. One model here, one example here. Whereas we need to think about this idea of transferability. If you go and build a LiDAR model somewhere, can you apply it somewhere else? So when we do have managers looking at LiDAR data, they're not sort of going back from scratch all the time and saying, I've got to go away and put plots in. I've got to go away and build models. Maybe there's a set of allometric equations that might become standard for LiDAR that we can run in different places. And then what are the new variables that we can use off that? So I think that's an exciting area. And then this other idea of LiDAR on a drone or handheld LiDAR, you know, I think these are other additional data sets. We can use many of the same tools. But we're getting extraordinary density or different perspectives that can help answer that as well.
Very cool, very cool.
I do think remote sensing of traits more broadly, there's a huge interest in remote sensing and phenotyping. So this idea of individual trees, but then their stress responses, how different species are reacting under a changing climate. So this idea of much more exacting remote sensing science at a tree or sub-crown level, and then looking to see, okay, well, would an oak at the top of its range versus an oak at the bottom of the range versus an oak at the middle of the range, how can you use remote sensing to understand the stress that that species is having across its range? Because all the species are moving. So this idea of remote sensing as a tool to help us understand assisted migration, how trees are moving across the landscape. Another really interesting area where, yeah, we know we can do it theoretically, and yes, we've had decades of remote sensing science to do that, but how might you do that operationally to actually understand how species are redistributing under climate change? I think another really exciting area to have remote sensing as a tool. I'll stop there. But there's a few there of different things that I think are really cool areas that we're working on.
No, very, very cool. And we haven't connected in a while, so it's good fun for me to hear that and get a refresher on what the lab's doing there. And so maybe a follow-on question from that. Based on those research themes or those research programs, what's missing? Do you think it's a technology like a sensor gap, or do you think it's a methods gap? And then really where I'm going with that is with the AI, like, are the methods you're using, building, have those fundamentally changed with the advent of AI, or maybe the adoption AI, when we think about neural networks and machine learning, that's been around in the science world, process automation world for quite a while, just maybe dubbed a different word. Gen AI is completely different. But maybe from a sensor technology point of view, because on the private sector, we've got lots of new hyperspectral sensors planned, new constellations coming online. How do you view it? Do you really see it as a science gap, or is it a technology gap? Is it a methods gap? Or knowing you by now, it's probably a marriage of all of them. But what do you think about that?
So that's tough. And you're right. I think it is a combination of all of them. I think methods-wise, AI and these advanced computing techniques allow us to integrate these different types of data more meaningfully and easily, perhaps. My students still use regression. And yet regression is a well established but challenging modeling framework to use when you have all these different data sets coming in all these different ways. We have data straight autocorrelation, spatial autocorrelation, temporal autocorrelation. You've got in some cases too many plots, in some places not enough plots. You've got various patchy data. In some cases we don't have enough data. In some cases we're overwhelmed with data. So how do you model that and do that appropriately is very difficult. And using traditional statistics is tough. And so, students love random forests because it's now come to a point of point and click. But one of the key benefits of random forest is the fact that you can bring in different types of data. And I see this revolution in terms of advanced computing and AI and machine learning is really just an extension of that, giving us more access to tools that allow us to go away and ingest this really different types of data sets and data sets that would, make a biometrician cringe in terms of all the violation that they have in terms of the basics that we want. So I do think there's methodological work there. I don't think AI is a hype. I do think, well, I think it's hyped, but I don't think it's useless. I think it's got massive potential because it really allows that methodological gap to be filled. Because I think we are running up against very difficult ways of processing all this data meaningfully with the types of simplistic models that we might have used in the past. So I think that's a methodological one. Technologically wise, it would, more detailed spectral information would be useful. There's no question about it. Hyperspectral information would be very, very beneficial in many of the applications that we have in forestry. The trick has always been the cost and the complexity of that additional information, and is it worth the effort? And in reality, it hasn't been worth the effort over large areas to help us go away and model our and monitor our forests. Over small areas, It might be. But we haven't had the technology that's allowed us to go and do that operationally on time in cost with a hyperspectral type model. And yet we're learning a lot all the time from hyperspectral, the whole idea of spectronomics, the whole idea that every species has a unique spectral signature, the idea that we're getting all these different pigments and nutrients and chemical composition. The idea that we're getting all of this out of the spectral signature and which bands to hone in on and how narrow should they be. Hyperspectral science has given us all of that. So hyperspectral science has really, and image spectroscopy has really given us the foundation, keeps giving us the foundation around what to look for with these broader scale sensors that we've been using. Hopefully one day we'll have the sensors operating like Landsat, operating like Sentinel that are hyperspectral. We're creeping towards that. We have nmap, we have some demonstrations on the space station. There's obviously other missions that people are talking about. Yeah, I hope we get there. But I don't regard hyperspectral as being a loss leader or not giving us information that we want, because I think it does still deliver very useful information into places where we apply it and use it. So, is it a technological gap? I think there's always space, there's always need for that technology, and there's always space for hyperspectral to come in there. It may never be the technology that we're always using wall to wall to go and do our mapping, but it's always going to be informing, I think, what we're looking at, when we're looking at, and these detailed case studies. So, a bit of a technological gap there. I'm excited by ideas like Planet. I think that cheaper, faster, quicker constellations are really a good idea, as long as you have the gold standard of Landsats and Sentinels to go away and compare it to. So a bit like my example of LiDAR airborne being the case study, and then you might use other technologies on top. I see it as pretty much the same way. If you wanted to be an optical only focus, it would be Landsat or Sentinel as your high quality initial imagery. And then you can think about change or things happening across the landscape using a snapshot type system that's offered by Planet. So, there's a lot of complexity in the in Planet in terms of calibration and monitoring over time and into calibration, sensor calibration of these instruments. But it's exciting to think that, we're getting every single day at 3 meters. And I do think there's a place for that data. It's proving to be a difficult nut to crack algorithmically. We are seeing companies use it, we are seeing people use it, but it's probably not being used to its fullest extent. We're trying to catch up with algorithms, we're trying to catch up with how you might quickly calibrate this data and how you might go and look at things over time. But I do see that as a gap that's being filled by these companies. And I think as the company matures, as the data matures, as technology gets better, we're going to see more of it. I don't see that as being a loss leader either. I think that's exciting, as long as you've always got that high quality data to go away and compare it to.
And that's where I'd be curious to know your thoughts, Nicholas, that when we touch on these things like Landsat and Sentinel, like public investments, common data goods, hands down proven, the value that's generated from this open data is key. And yet we have a lot of private companies that some might argue without the military, what do you call it, the industrial complex, essentially paying defense organizations, paying for some of these private sector constellations going up, systems going up, that they're non-viable. Just wondering your thoughts, like, what do we need to do to change the narrative? Or in your seat, maybe pull you, stretch your thinking out there. What narrative do we need to change to somehow get maybe that on a different footing where it's not driven by defense applications that Sentinel and Landsat have clearly shown the value from this? How do we change the narrative there to so it becomes economically feasible, or maybe more economically feasible than maybe where it is right now? Because certainly in 2021, with the VC dollars coming in, like, there's this boom. You can see charts, all these companies like raising tons of money, and then it pretty much nosedived and flatlined from there. Do you think we need to change the discourse there with I don't know, society, community, government, you name it?
That's you're getting a bit they're tough questions, and I don't have strong views about that. I think
My goal is just to stump you, by the way, so
Well, you've done
everyone.
it. You've done it. But I don't really have any answers to the industrial military complex. And where remote sensing fits into that. I think it behooves us as remote sensing scientists to always recognize the value of these long-term, high-quality, state-based assets like Landsat and Sentinel. We can't take them for granted. And we do need to keep pushing society or our governments to keep producing that. And in Canada, our investment has been in RADARSAT, which the country is continuing to invest in. I do the same thing here. I don't think the benefit of archive RADARSAT has been mined appropriately, and I don't think we have full access to RCM data, RADARSAT Constellation mission, the newest RADARSAT. I think if there's more work to be done there in terms of making sure we're using and promoting and investing in these state-based remote sensing systems. We can't take those for granted. We've got to keep working on them, got to keep demonstrating them and justifying them. But there's also this place for these newer technologies, these new players that come in. And as a remote sensing researcher, I'm always open to using those as much as I can, getting students to use them as much as I can, because they offer new perspectives. I'm always optimistic about the different data streams that come in, always excited by what they might offer. Some might come and go, and some might not live to the promise that they have. But that's no reason that we shouldn't be getting our students to look. I mean, the university is a great place. A company shouldn't be investing in a forestry company is going to find it very tough to go and invest in a brand new technology of some sort of salesman coming in, go away and use this. It's going to be hard for them to evaluate whether that's useful or not. Come and partner with a university. Universities are great places to go away and do that. Students are relatively cheap. So we are really good to go away and test those things with you. And then maybe you can make a more educated decision then around whether they're useful or not. And it just gives that additional perspective to the salesperson perspective, that's going to obviously give a fairly rosy one about the technology. So I think I can't answer more broadly about what needs to change, but I think it does demonstrate why how the private sector can work with universities to sort of test the utility of these new technologies that are continually coming online, which ones work and which ones don't.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a great segue. We promised we would talk a little bit more about Silva Laser, and one you've mentioned, and I agree, LiDAR is, the gold standard there. So we've got an event coming up later on in the year in Quebec City in Canada called Silva Laser. Possibly Silva Laser, a great example of just what you talked about, where you have academia, industry, forestry companies or the forestry private sector, they're coming together. But what can you tell me about Silva Laser, the history of the origin, because there's a long one. And maybe we'll start with that. What is Silva Laser for our audience, and what's planned for later this year?
Okay, so I cannot put this any clearer to the audience. Come to Silva Laser. So Silva Laser is a great conference. It originally was every single year. It's been around about 20 years. Silva, obviously, of the forestry focused, and then laser was obviously the LiDAR focus initially. So very LiDAR forestry focused initially, and it was an annual conference. It bounces around the world, often in Europe, North America, and then a more exotic location, and then Europe, North America, an exotic location. So a great conference, because it is so tied to forests and forestry. It is very applied, and so you get a lovely conference from very, very theoretical. We often hear about new LiDAR technologies, new remote sensing technologies, all the way through to examples of applications of LiDAR, and then forestry companies attend, or NGOs attend, or governments attend, and then or government representatives, and talk about how this technology is being used to help them answer actual questions. So it's nice because we have everything from single photon LiDAR development all the way through to mapping the habitat of the spotted owl, and everything in between. And that's why I've always found it such a refreshing conference, because it covers that diversity. Obviously, over the years, we've grown with lasers, so it does everything from TLS. Terrestrial LiDAR, very strong group, continues to join and be part of Silver Laser all the way through. Drones have obviously massively changed the conference in the last decade. Satellite LiDAR has also changed it in the last decade. And then, of course, airborne's always been a key theme throughout. And we've also broadened now really to think about 3D technologies. So we welcome the photogrammetry audience, the 3D photogrammetry contribution to that. We know these are complementary technologies, not necessarily competing. So a lot of there's a fair proportion of papers that come in talking about photogrammetry. They're welcome as well. It'll go over 3 days, well, it's a week. So it's September 29 to October 3rd. The first day, the Monday, is a series of workshops. We've got a LiDAR workshop, an Aztools workshop. We've got other research groups coming and talking about the work that they've been doing as a series of workshops. And there's an early career session that we're running on the Monday. And then we've got Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, which are the research talks. And then we have the Friday, which is an optional field trip where we go and see some actual companies developing LiDAR technologies in Quebec City. And then we go out into the forest. The conference is in Quebec City. It is the oldest walled city in North America. It is a spectacular city. It's like Europe, but better plumbing. So, a great place to come. A city I love. French is spoken, but English is obviously spoken as well. So, a great chance to brush up on your French. And a really good place. It's at the Congress Center, which is the premier place in Quebec City to have it. And then it's being co-hosted by myself, but the main host is Alexis Achim. So Alexis is University of Laval, which is a university in Quebec City. Alexis, originally a silviculturalist, but has now seen the light, works a lot with LiDAR. And in fact, the package LiDAR came out with JR, came out of Alexis's lab. So it's great that he's willing to host it over there. We've had it in Vancouver in 2012, so it was a great chance to bring it to the east. Many of the remote sensing and LiDAR folks in Canada are contributing to that. And a great three keynote speakers of one of which is Kevin Lim. So thank you for agreeing to come to that and talk, and you represent, I think, well, a great part of what we're trying to get to in Silver 21. Firstly, one of the first people to use it in Canada. Your original articles are still cited by my students today about how you might use Canada a LiDAR and operational sense in Canada. So there's that part of you that we love. But then, of course, this commercial success that you've had with your company, now with Remsoft, an extraordinary successful career. And that real interesting mix then of your background, a little bit in academia through your PhD, early adopter, and now as a commercial vendor, exactly the type of person we want there. So you are a very natural choice to speak, and I think demonstrates to your listeners why Silver Laser is so good, because we actually hear from people like you. So please come. It's every 2 years now. So our last one was in London, UK, and now it's in Quebec City. So a 2 year conference, and we again the last week of September, September 29 to October 3rd. The website is open. Registrations are open. We've reviewed all the abstracts, and we'll be releasing the abstract and who's accepted for papers and posters in about a week.
About a week. Very cool. And definitely, I echo everything Nicholas said. It's a fantastic event. I know in the past, some folks I know from the private sector, maybe not within academia, they're like, oh, like, I don't know if I'm going to go. Like, there's a lot of smart people, big brains there. And then I said, just go. Like, seriously, just go. And they went. And then when I followed up after, they're like, it was amazing. It's like, I understood them. It was about forestry. I'm like, to your point, they're like, you work in forestry. Of course, you're going to understand the forestry stuff, and it's like there's some remote sensing there, and so they came away absolutely loving it. And to your point, La Belle Province, the Quebec there, it's beautiful. It's like love going there myself as well. So hopefully folks will sign on and join in. So as we look to wind down, I just have maybe one or two more questions there. And again, I know you're busy. You probably got to go do stuff with people research and whatnot. I'm curious to know when you maybe to come full circle. So you said, you're there in Vancouver at UBC doing this great research, publishing like a machine, great science. Is there something before the end of your research career, you've got something that's developed over the years that you're a nut you really want to crack? Just something that you're like, man, it's like before I'm done, like mentoring students and contributing to science, although I suspect you'll keep doing that, in the future. Is there a research theme or a research question that you're just like, I gotta solve this in my, what are you on now? Your second 15-year block, and maybe there's a third one. But is there something that you're just like, What did, I need to solve this. And if so, what would that be?
So no, there's not. I will die. I will likely die at my desk, much to my husband's horror. I will likely die at my desk. I want to write a book. So I want to write a novel. And I want to somehow br
On remote
transfer
sensing, right? A novel on remote sensing.
a novel on. So Chris Hadfield, the guy, the American, no, oh my God, the Canadian commander of the space station, who sang that David Bowie song, he's written a murder mystery in space. I want to write something that conveys my passion and love for looking at the Earth from above. I always want the window seat, but I want to write a novel that conveys that in some way. I guess it doesn't need to be a murder mystery, but it needs to be something. And I'd like to do that. I'd like to write a book. So that would be, that's on the bucket list. Not a textbook, but a book. But it's sort of remote sensing related, so that's my bucket list. But I don't no, I don't have something in particular that I feel needs to be cracked. My love of my job is the diversity. It's the fresh input of students every year. It's working with them closely for 4 or 5 years and then seeing them succeed. I love that. It's the key part of what I love in my job. I build these friendships and relationships that, will last all my life. And that's what I want to keep doing. And that's what I want to cultivate. And that's what I where I get my joy. So if I'm able to keep doing that without being the old man who gets in the way of these students, then I want to keep doing this all the way through. So I want to keep as positive I can and fresh as I can and enthusiastic as I can till I'm done.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. And maybe that story will have you in the window seat of that Millennium Falcon on the back of
Maybe.
your wall, and yeah,
Maybe.
spin it off to a Disney Star Wars things. But we will see, I suppose. We'll wait for that to come. Well, hey, I really appreciate your time, Nicholas. And for those who want to reach Dr. Nicholas Coops, what's the best way for folks to get a hold of you?
Email nicholas.coops@ubc.ca. Happy to talk to anyone. Students, reach out to me if you're interested in coming. We're always looking for new students. Canada's a magnificent country. Vancouver's a spectacular city. UBC is a really good university. Welcome that. Welcome collaborations across the world. I'm always interested in talking to people. I'm a pretty terrible typist, so email me. I'll email back, but more than happy to jump on a Zoom and just chat through things. Any stuff to follow up on, more than happy to do that as well. Always at your disposal and happy to help.
Awesome, awesome. Well, there you go, folks. If you want to reach Dr. Coops, nicholas.coops@ubc.ca. So thanks very much, Nicholas. Really enjoyed the conversation. I know we'll see each other in Quebec City later in the fall, if not sooner, but definitely appreciate you carving out some time for me to have this conversation. So wishing you all the best.
My pleasure. Thank you.